Accession number 30394, Reel 4.
We lived at first in bell tents, and I didn't count them. There must have been well over a dozen to each tent. And you're sleeping on the ground sheet, head on something of a kit, with a towel on top, and you're within inches of the next man's head. I don't know how we put up with it, but I can remember there, we were joined by ATS. They were in a different billet, of course. But we used to queue up at the same, outside the same mess room. And I've always been a great lover of food. And I was hungry and I was restless. And they still hadn't opened the mess room to go in. And I'm sitting there with one of these oblong aluminium mess tins, flicking, holding the end away from the handle and flicking the handle upside down. And the ATS guard in front of me was quite close, and inadvertently I goosed her. You know what a goose is. And I apologised, and she accepted that, and all was well, but I still had an element of embarrassment within me, so I flicked it again and I goosed her again. If ever anyone could have wished the earth to open up, that was it. Yes, I remember looking out at Portsmouth, because my brother had trained there, and I'm wondering, you know, just exactly where his ship was.
How much contact did you have with him?
Not a lot, and though we still keep in touch briefly, he does not look back on his forces career during the war. You know, they say a lot of people don't talk about it. I don't think his experiences were that frightening, although he was on the North Atlantic convoy route quite a lot, and then on the Russian convoys. And he was stationed in Reykjavik at one stage in Iceland. Is Iceland, not Greenland, and his job was a coder, decoding and coding messages. So he was, you know, in the bowels of the ship. He wasn't, but he's never talked a lot about it.
Did you know what ship he was on, even?
Oh, Lord. His first one was one of the destroyers which the Americans had made free to us. There were 50 frigates or destroyers which they had in harbour and had no use for, and they released them to us for convoy escorts. Oh, Janet. Where is she? Could I have a paracetamol, please? Because round about now I eat normally. And if I don't have a regular meal, I get... No, he's never been a great discusser of his wartime experiences. Clumsy. That's the trouble about diabetes. You lose the feeling. But thank God, not in my brain or my heart.
Did you move to Portsmouth after D-Day?
No, before, because we were there to meet up with the rest of the unit, which was War Office Signals, to do the actual, the British side, the control side of the various things that were going on. And I don't remember, apart from one occasion, being told much what was going on. But there was one occasion when one or two of us were walking through one of the tunnels under those castles, Fort Widley, Fort Southwark. Hold on a minute. And there was a brigadier, and he amazingly got talking to us and telling us that the landings had been successful. So that was a sort of little bit of a boost. I think I was just coming out of the phase of being regarded as a junior soldier who's only fit to carry messages, you know, the written message from office to office. And I would still have been doing that had I not spoken up. Because if that's one of the things I do, I speak up. Well, you've got to, haven't you? It's one of the lessons of life.
And what happened after D-Day?
Ah, now. Well, Winston Churchill said, as we're now established, Signalman Flint can be permitted, I'm joking now, to cross the channel. In fact, we were sent to somewhere in Kent, Bromley or Beckenham, on embarkation leave. So it was obvious that it was not a secret thing, we were going to actually go across the water. So I went home for a week, said goodbye to my parents. They photographed me, it's somewhere in those albums, between my father and my mother. There I sat in uniform. I suppose they wanted a potential souvenir in case I didn't come back. And then we went down to somewhere near Portsmouth, Gosport area, into one of these holding camps where you weren't allowed to go out of the camp. You just had to, you know, sit tight until you were ready to go. And then one day our section moved out, and to one of the concrete hards near Gosport. There was water between the landing ship and land, so we had to go out on the clinging to an artillery quad, which was the vehicle that pulled the gun. We got aboard the ship, the landing ship, and glory be, we were entitled, because we're on a Royal Navy ship, to an issue of rum, or grog, I should say. And we had a mug full of rum and water. Some people did not like it, so I got a spare mug of rum passed on to me. And then uh one of his coffees cold enough to drink. Then the next morning we set out. Oh, that's better. And of course came ashore at Aramash to the, I've forgotten the code word temporarily. Yeah. But there were signs of damage as we drove ashore. And as soon as we were clear of the harbour area, there was a huge camp of German prisoners of war. And all my instincts said, you poor buggers, there you are. You've lost the war, you're milling around, you're prisoners. I hope they're giving you some kind of food. And I remember quite clearly pointing and saying, look at those poor bastards. And one of the blokes who'd been in the war in the Middle East said, no, they're not, Errol. We're fighting them. Don't feel sorry for them. But I'm sorry, I had to feel sorry for them. And then we drove on after a night at this camp on the outskirts of it. And we ended up in a village in Normandy called Marbeuf. And after settling down there in a disused chateau, finding our bed, making beds in the stables, because I could speak French quite well, unofficially, certainly at a lower level, I became the translator. Interpreter's the word, isn't it? And I got to know this family, the Levasseur family, and they took me under their wing socially, you know. They were running a garage come bar, and they would offer me the odd drink, and it was lovely. I was accepted into a family, which taught me what I'd learnt in the army cadets. Families are essential. So, at one stage, I was even finding that I was teaching a young daughter of the family who was about to become the French equivalent of... Oh! What's the thing where you learn the creed?
Pardon?
What is the thing you have to do to when you're learning the creed? You're about to become...
Confirmed.
The French equivalent of being confirmed. And I remember very clearly going through this creed with this girl, I suppose, and the words, Je suis chrétien, I'm a Christian. It was lovely. And then at one stage they invited me to an evening dinner. Oh, and the food. It was, of course, a farm area in Normandy, so there was no shortage of sausages or meat or vegetables. And it was lovely. But halfway through the meal, they had what is in English called the Normandy hole, or le trou normand, where you stop eating and you just sit around talking and drinking what I feel is one of the finest drinks on God's earth, Calvados. Lovely. Erzatz coffee, but Calvados with it, Calvados. Ah, happy days. And our main job was keeping a network going that whoever and whatever unit was at the front line, if they sent back asking for supplies, food, ammunition, petrol, we passed it on back to the main area, Alamarsh, where it was all stored. Any chance of a biscuit, Jenny? I'm not exactly faint, but I'm tired. After the war, when I was on holiday, I used to go on hitchhiking round the Normandy coast. The Normandy, food.
Would you like a biscuit?
If she keeps me alive. And we, going with a few bachelor friends, we found our way to Marbeuf, re-met the family, and they sat us down in their bar, and we did not drink ourselves under the table, but by golly, we were close to it. The other thing I remember, at some stage we stopped at a farm, and somebody said to me, see if you can get some cider. So I had a word with the farmer's wife, and she was quite happy. She produced a huge jug of farm cider.
This was after the war, was it?
This was during the war. And it was, I think they do it down in the West Country, scrumpy. It was not a clear cider. It was slightly cloudy. And we sat and we drank and we drank, went to bed. In the middle of the night, most of us were attacked by diarrhea. And we went to this corner of this field and squatted down, emptied our bowels. And in those days, the pack rations that you were issued with did not have toilet paper. But we as signals had plenty of message pads, and they just simply took a pad, a blank forms, ripped a few off, wiped their backside, and that was it. And the next morning, its corner of the field was littered with brown patches and pieces of message forms. So message forms did have a good use. And we moved gradually up the line. I remember we stopped at one point and picked up some French civilians, and they cadged a lift onto a town they were going to. So we made ourselves useful. We stopped at one point, I know, to take on petrol, which had been piped across the channel on the Pluto system, pipeline under the ocean. And then we drove on to Brussels.
Had you been generally well received by the French population?
Yes. We were warned at one stage to be wary of the odd collaborator firing at us, sniping us, but it never happened. I think probably it was a precaution. There were the very occasional collaborators firing at British troops. In Brussels, a lot of soldiers, British soldiers, are smoking cigars captured from the Germans, issued free, so that was good. I'd never smoked a cigar in my life. Some of the blokes had scrounged a stubby little thing like a cigarette holder to smoke the cigar, but all we did was break off a matchstick and poke that into the end, and that was something to bite on. But on the continent, you had to be careful with matches, because although I'd been taught to strike a match towards me, that's the British match, on the continent you learned to strike it away from you, because the wooden stick easily broke and you didn't want the flame coming towards you. Oh, I didn't think talking could tell me out so much. So in Brussels, not a lot to report. I think we were close to one of the big squares where they had a lot going on. I told you, I think we mostly drank beer rather than wine. We didn't have any specific job to do, and then Christmas Eve, I'm called into the section office, and the officer says, "Flint, the good news, you're going home in a couple of days' time. The bad news, you're probably going out east." So I'm sent off to Ostend, or in fact Bruges, which was the sort of assembly point for going to Ostend. And at Bruges we learnt about the Battle of the Bulge. Not very pleasant. And then on to I'm a little bit fuzzy.
While you were still in Europe, did you have any contact with the Americans at all?
No. I've had two very small connections with American forces. One was seeing American troops on sentry somewhere in Portsmouth itself, and the other was having connections with an American wireless operator, air support, their equivalent of our air support signal units, and his handwriting was dreadful. That's the only memory I've got.
How were you received by the population in Brussels and Belgium as a whole?
I think they were friendly. They certainly were not antagonistic. No, I think they were perfectly friendly. I think they were glad to see us. Trying to think. The Battle of the Bulge hadn't really started then in Brussels. And then I was soon out of it, onto Bruges, and then onto Ostend. Now, before we got on the merchant ship, which had been converted to a troop carrier at Ostend, we were warned there were rumours of midget submarines in the North Sea, and we were to wear our life jackets or life belts at all time. We're a couple of hours out on the way back to England, and the warning went, you know, report to lifeboat stations. And I remember as I ran across the smooth deck, I slid and a sailor grabbed me and stopped me falling against the rails. And then we got back to England, which was nice, and on a train up to Huddersfield. Whenever I watch rugby league matches, I go for Huddersfield. And there we were in the early hours of the morning, assembling, I think, the blackout had been largely disposed of, certainly relaxed, with the NCO in charge with a lantern. And then off on leave again. And it was nice to be home, and I think my parents were glad. But I was fairly certain we were going out east, and the newsreels were full of the dreadful scenes of Burma, the conditions. And we still regarded the Japanese as being at least equal, perhaps superior to us. And I didn't think my chances of coming back were very good. And the one thing I did not want was the girlfriend I'd got in Dover being informed that Ken's prisoner of war or killed or missing or whatever. So I went down to Dover and broke the news that we had to break it off. And I remember she took all my love letters and put them on the fire. But I didn't really think I had any alternative, you know. So, well, actually I was lucky, because later on I met a woman who's really been wonderful.